Hey, welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you're a returning subscriber, hey, bestie, you have a beautiful smile and the world's a better place because you're in it. See what happens when you subscribe? You get a bonus greeting on every single episode. On this episode, we talk to the one and only Fabiana of Embraer. She has such a cool story, such a cool background. She joined Embraer at a time when they were coming out of a DPA, and she did so many smart things to really drive her compliance program to the heart of the business, to not be an office of no, but really by building trust, become a business enabler. I think you're going to love this episode a lot. This was really great. So I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Fabiana.
Hey.
What's happening?
A lot of things on tariffs, Brazil, US.
Some very busy days. Right, yeah. Well, welcome to the Ethics Experts. So happy to have you on. I'd love to dive right in. I want to, you know, you have a really cool story. Your journey's been really exciting. I think you've had so many cool experiences, not just about, you know, navigating through, you know, DPAs and stuff like that, but also like what happens after the DPA and how you've really moved your program from the anti-sales department to really the business enablement department. And then if we have time, we can get into some tariff stuff. How's that sound?
That sounds great. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. And on the tariffs, I will answer to the best of my ability. Okay.
Yeah. Well, no one knows what's going on with tariffs right now.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
Nobody knows. So before we kind of dive into your, you know, professional story, I always like to talk about, you know, what were you like as a kid? What was it like growing up? And how did those experiences in childhood really kind of lay the foundation for what you're doing now?
That's a very good question, and well, I wasn't prepared for that, but I'm gonna play by ear here. So I was I come from a Jewish family from Brazil, and my grandparents were they fled Poland and they fled Romania before the war. So I had a family that started from nothing in Brazil. And what I've learned my whole life is that what you have is your name, your ethical behavior, and your education, because you never know what's going to happen. So I grew up in that environment where ethics was at the top of our principles in family-wise and education. So what my father always said that, because you never know what's going to happen, because he said, see, my parents were married in Poland and had to flee the country and start from zero. So what you have to do is study to be a very good professional and be able to work whatever you are. And you have to keep a good name. Your name cannot be tarnished. That's what he said. So this is something that guided me throughout my childhood and then my professional life. I decided to be a lawyer, not because of that. I come from a family of doctors. So when I was young, we had three options, right? You either went to medical school, to law school, or to engineering school. And I decided law school. So there weren't that many options as you have today. But at the end of the day, it made a lot of sense and a lot of connection to the way I was raised and to the way I behaved my whole life since I was a kid.
Why did your family choose Brazil?
That's a funny story. They didn't choose Brazil. You know, everybody who fled Europe at that time would choose America.
Right.
Right. And everybody was getting a ship, and they weren't very well educated there. And that's one of the reasons why my father said you have to get your education and you have to go to a good school and study very hard. So everybody thought they were going to America, and that happened to many families in South America, Brazil, Argentina. So they thought they were going to North America because this was America for them. Some of them actually were going to America, and then the ports were closed, right? Immigration for America was closed, and the ships diverted back south. But some of them, like my grandparents, I think they thought they were going to America, and they didn't know there was a difference between North America and South America. They ended up in Brazil.
How crazy is that? Imagine.
That's very crazy. That's
and then
very
here
crazy.
You are.
Yeah, here I am.
Wow. You know, it's
that's very crazy.
It's interesting when you come from a family that has sort of lost everything. It's like what's left over are the things that really matter. To your point, it's like your education, your word, who you are as a person. Like when you boil it all away, that's really all that's left. And I think there's a lot of good that can come from that. Obviously, losing everything is terrible. You know, fleeing your home country is terrible, especially under, you know, the circumstances that they likely left. But to get that kind of a message and get that kind of a value or get those values conveyed, it's transcended generations. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of built who you are today and the things that like you prioritize and probably, you know, it's had such an impact on all those folks around you.
Yeah. Especially in my generation, because we still had that connection with grandparents. Now, right. The next generation, they didn't get to meet the grandparents who fled because they were deceased by when my daughters were born, for example. So they didn't have that closeness that can translate into us learning exactly what matters in life.
Which then again, kind of to that point, makes it so much more important for us who are in those subsequent generations to hold on to those core things, because like they're so fleeting. It's so easy to forget those stories that really, you know, formed the fabric of our families and formed the sort of DNA that, you know, is in us now.
Exactly.
All right. So you don't want to be an engineer. You don't want to go to medical school. You go to law school. What was that experience like for you? And how did you like that experience? Was that something that really fed you? And was that something that, like, when did you know that you were on the right path?
When I was like 14 or 15, I already knew I was going to be a lawyer. I was actually between medical school and law school, and because I would like to be a doctor as well. But I thought, there are too many doctors in my family. My brother is a doctor. And I said, no, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to go to law school. I went to a very good law school in Brazil, which was ranked the first there. So it was a very good public law school. And it was, I think, the experience that formed me, like that shaped me for the future. It was in Brazil, it's 5 years, and it's law school is undergrad. So it's not grad school. So it's the 5 years that I study there and work at the same time because it's part-time. And then when I graduated, right, I think 3 years after, I came to the U.S. for an LLM, which is a law's master. And there was a second chapter of my education in law that really formed me and made me fall in love with the international aspects of law.
So,
and then I went.
What was it? Did you notice any differences between like the approach to learning law in Brazil versus what your experience in the United States was? Like, was there any difference in terms of philosophy, or how did that experience in the United States really kind of round you out and add more sort of dimensionality to, you know, you as a lawyer?
It's completely different. Completely. Brazil has a what we call civil law system, while the United States has a common law system. The civil law system is based on laws only and regulations. The common law system is based in large on precedents and how the courts resolve issues and going forward. So it's very different from one another. When I set for the bar in the U.S., I had to kind of relearn everything from a U.S. perspective, because it's counterintuitive for us who are from a civil law system to understand the common law system. And it gave me a broader view, as I said, on the international aspects of law. And it gave me the certainty that I wanted to work in a global environment and with international laws and international transactions.
Are those kind of the two kind of structures, common and civil, like across the world?
Yes, basically.
Got it. Okay. So you're kind of well-versed in both now.
Yeah.
What is, I'm just curious, like, what are the main differences? I understand under common law, precedent is what kind of determines the law, but how does that like differ? Like, what's different about that in actuality on a day-to-day basis? Is it just more stuff to learn, more stuff to consider beyond just the words of the law itself? You have to understand like sort of these other cases.
Yes, many different things. For example, in Brazil, if you have a contract but you have a verbal contract, it doesn't matter. You have to have everything written down. In the U.S., for example, in certain circumstances, if you have a verbal contract, that's a contract.
It is a contract,
right?
Yeah.
It is. So this is just one example, but many different examples, and I had to relearn after that. And after the LLM, I worked in the U.S. for 4 more years in a U.S. law firm with Brazilian clients, Spanish clients, Latin American clients, but doing U.S. law. So it was a very good experience and provided me with a very good notion of how both systems differ and how both systems work together.
So what did you like about that 4-year experience? You sat for the bar, you're working in a law firm in America. You did that for 4 years, working with these international clients, these Latin American clients. How did you like that experience? And what did you really gather from that you've been able to reference or rely upon as, in your kind of life in compliance now?
Okay. I love that experience, to be honest. And I was working mainly with mergers and acquisitions and the capital market. So it's a very intense work. I love that experience, but I understand that it's a very, very intense. And then this was from 98 to 2001. And then I got pregnant in 2001. It was, we were planning, and I realized that even if I loved the experience, I wouldn't be able to have both, right? To have a baby in New York and continue to have all-nighters and no help at all, because both of our families were back in Brazil. And then it came. Then September 11 came in 2001, and I was 6 weeks pregnant. And at that time, we decided, I think it's time maybe to go back and go to be closer to family and go back to Brazil. But I don't think I would have left that early if it weren't for all the circumstances. Then I went back to Brazil, but I wanted to go through the corporate world.
Yeah.
And that's why I joined DuPont, the Brazilian subsidiary of DuPont. And right away, this was 2002, I started to work with legal and compliance. It was my first experience working in compliance.
So that's super interesting.
Yeah, I think that experience of working in the U.S. and working in a U.S. environment helped me work in a U.S. company subsidiary in Brazil.
In what ways?
Because I knew the system, I knew how the culture, the culture is completely different from the Brazilian, from the U.S. culture. And I had the U.S. culture very fresh because I was living here for 5 years. And so when I joined, it was very easy.
Yeah. How would you characterize those differences? Because I'm not very familiar with the Brazilian culture. How does that differ, or how does that differ from the American culture? Or how would you just sort of characterize that at just sort of a high level what some of those sort of basic differences are?
Okay, there are two main aspects of culture, the relationship aspect and the work environment aspect, right? So relationship-wise, Brazilians and I think Latins are like that. They are much more outgoing and the relationships are much closer. And whereas in the U.S., you have the personal space where everybody just go to work, they work and they leave. Even if they make friends at work, it's not as close or as open as you have in Brazil. And this is a very important cultural difference because, for example, in Brazil and I think Latin America in general, we hug, we kiss, and you can't do that in the U.S., right? It's very different. And there is this clash. It's very funny when you see people from Brazil when they first interact with people from the U.S. and you introduce them. Now I think it's more globalized, but at that time, like the U.S. person would just put their hands up for a handshake, and the Brazilian guy would just open their arms to hug. So that's on the relationship level. On the professional level, I think the U.S. people are much more pragmatic, and they know how to differentiate between business and a relationship. You can in the U.S. you can be friends and enemies at the same time. You can have, for example, a lawsuit against that person and be negotiating an agreement on the side. That doesn't happen in Brazil or in Latin America in general. You take it personally. So you need to know how to navigate.
My dad is from Cuba, so maybe that explains why I take everything so personal myself.
Yeah.
So you joined DuPont. It's 2001.
2002.
I'm sorry. Yeah. 2002. And that was kind of an interesting time for compliance, right? Because Sarbanes-Oxley was just coming out in the United States. It's kind of was like this new sort of resurgence. Maybe resurgence is the wrong word, but it was a real kind of a seminal moment around that time for, you know, the creation of corporate compliance programs. So talk a little bit about how that sort of looked for you in Brazil, working for this, working for this American company in Brazil, joining this legal team. And, you know, what were you working on from a compliance perspective, and what did that sort of look like? Was that being pushed down from the States? Was it kind of emerging on its own sort of concurrently in Brazil? And what were you kind of focused on?
So I may be wrong, but I think DuPont had the first chief compliance officer in the U.S.
Cool. Wow.
And the first role as a chief compliance officer, and the role that was directly connected to legal. And I can't give you her name. Her name is Marjorie Doyle. And when she left DuPont, she left to be, a chief compliance officer in a company that was undergoing a DPA or something like that. And now she's still around and she trains. She's a member of the SCCE, and she trains people around the world on compliance in companies, cool. Even Embraer. When I joined Embraer, she had performed trainings at Embraer. And it was a very unique experience to be part of a company that had the first chief compliance officer. And at that time, I said, that's interesting. What does that mean, right? So DuPont was starting with the trainings, the corporate trainings, and all the preventive measures, the compliance program, all the controls. This was all new to me. But DuPont had a very interesting culture. From an American standpoint, it was a company that we would call, when we joined DuPont, the pickle effect. You know, pickle, when you put like many different vegetables in a jar and you pickle them, at the end of the day, when you take them out, they all taste the same.
Right.
That's what they would say. So they say whoever joins DuPont, because the culture of compliance and ethics were so strong throughout the company's life, whoever joined the company became one of the pickle. Like we all thought the same. So it was a very strong compliance culture, very strong ethical culture. Safety was a very strong, was one of the core values, actually. So the culture was so strong that I didn't face any issues, even in Brazil, to start implementing a compliance program.
Wow.
Everybody was always attuned, which was very different when I joined Embraer, and Embraer was just finishing a six-year investigation.
So what do you attribute that to? I mean, that's extremely interesting, right? It's almost, yeah. It sounds like this first compliance officer, she was stepping into an environment that was very sort of conducive for compliance stuff.
Yeah. I attribute it to the long time that DuPont was around. DuPont, when I joined in 2002, DuPont had just completed 200 years of existence.
Oh my gosh.
It was even older than the U.S. government, because I think when DuPont was created, it was selling gunpowder to the North.
Wow.
During the wars. Yes. So it's even before the U.S. government. And I think it went through so many different issues. If you go to the law books, you have antitrust cases that involve DuPont. You have other cases that involve DuPont. So I think after that, I think you start building all of the defenses and the culture that the company needs to make sure that these cases don't happen again. So after 200 years, you have a company that have a very established culture and a very established way of cascading that culture throughout the company. The company had around like 30 to 40,000 employees, and all of them were pickles, as I said.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
You know, like when you have little kids, they're like sick all the time, you know, and it's like as they age, their body builds these antibodies and these defenses against all the infections that they can get and all the viruses and stuff like that. That's kind of interesting that, you know, this company that's extremely old, it kind of like built these antibodies naturally so that when the compliance team kind of came in, it wasn't like, you know, it was kind of pushing some stuff forward, of course, I'm sure. But the circumstances for success of that function, which was the first one, as you said, you know, kind of the way was paved already. That's kind of cool.
So they were just implementing the controls, implementing the policies and the processes. But I would say the culture was already there.
Wow.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, that sounds really wild. I'd love to have her on the show and kind of pick her brain about that experience.
Marjorie Doyle.
Remember the name. Doyle. All right,
you
I will.
Love her.
Okay. So let's talk about that experience some more. So what did you start? Because I mean, here you are now, compliance executive, compliance pro, but you kind of started getting into legal and compliance again, working sort of at a very interesting time in sort of the life cycle of our industry. You started rolling out some, you know, some of those basic controls, as you said. What aspects of the compliance program really resonated with you, and what really kind of drove your interest to kind of pivot now again to a career in compliance?
I think all of them. And because it was the Brazilian part, like Brazilian counterpart of the legal and compliance function, I was able not only to implement these processes, but all investigations went through us in Brazil. So I think the hotline channel at the time was something that was very interesting to me, that it was a line where all employees can easily and safely report any kind of violations. That was something that really interested me, to make sure that we would correct any mistakes and investigate any mistakes in the company. And I think the aspects that, of course, the bureaucratic aspects of compliance, I think, are the least interesting, right? When you have to make sure that everybody complete their trainings, build it, like fill their forms and do everything, it's the least one. But I think the whole aspect of making sure that you do the right thing and that you have the controls in place to either prevent or correct, I think are very interesting to me.
Did you find in that company of pickles that the amount of risk intelligence that you were able to get your eyes on was more than maybe you have seen in other companies? Or was it kind of normal? You know what I'm asking?
Not exactly. Can you?
So, you know, in our industry at sort of a macro level, companies are getting kind of between one and let's say four reports per 100 people. I see in our data set that there's like a pretty wide standard deviation across different businesses. And sometimes it's based on size, sometimes it's based on industry. You've worked, you know, at a couple of these really large organizations where you're at now, and DuPont. And I'm just wondering what impact that this company DuPont, what impact did the culture at DuPont have on the propensity for stakeholders to speak up about things? Was there any meaningful impact on that? Did you feel like you got more of that sort of risk intelligence, more sort of speak up reports from folks than you would, or than maybe would be on average?
I think it's funny because I think first, your first question, the culture has a big impact on this, but I think because the culture is so strong, you don't have like as many reports as other companies, because you only have the meaningful reports and the reports when really there is a violation.
Interesting.
So, for example, when you compare with Embraer, I had so much less reports at DuPont that we had to investigate. Embraer, we have now a very high number of reports in our hotline, because since we started with the hotline and saying that it's a no retaliation line that is completely safe and everything, I think people just want to speak up, even if it's out of scope or even if it's something that's behavioral and should be dealt with by HR or directly with the person they're complaining about. But I think people just feel that need, you know, that they didn't have before, to just speak up and start putting things in there. So we have to filter everything and then make sure that we investigate everything, but make sure that we educate people at Embraer to use the channel smartly. Whereas at DuPont, people were already educated to use the channel very smartly because they had the culture there.
So then I would probably guess that at DuPont, your like rate of anonymous reports was probably a little bit lower. And there was probably even a higher rate of like quote unquote reports being made to managers as opposed to using this anonymous channel that exists.
Exactly. Or HR, yes, they knew what to look for.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So so you spent like, 15 years or something like that at DuPont?
15, yes. So 15 and now 9 at Embraer.
Wow. Okay. So talk to me a little bit more about like, what were some of the biggest lessons you learned from your time at DuPont that have allowed you to be even more impactful now at Embraer? Okay, like, what are some more of those stories? What are some more of those experiences in this really kind of special company, this really special culture that really has allowed you to make more of an impact and be even more successful over at Embraer?
And the first lesson that I learned, and this is something that I've been carrying, and I think we talked about that before, is you have to talk about the past. So because I told you that DuPont was a 200 plus year old company and had gone through so much, they used the cases as examples of something not to do again. And I think that's one thing that helped build the compliance program at Embraer and helped build this culture, is to inform and let people know what happened, right? When I joined Embraer, everything was very confidential because the whole investigation was confidential. But once we settled with the authorities, I decided at the compliance function that we should go around the world to provide training to everybody. So that first year after the settlement, that's 2017, I traveled from Portugal to China, Singapore. I went everywhere just to train people. And I would start every training by talking about the cases. This is what we did. This is a violation of the FCPA, and that's why we shouldn't do anymore. And these are the consequences of what we did. So I think that this is something I learned at DuPont. First, the transparency, and second, like, we should talk about the past. We cannot just jump to the part of building culture without letting everybody know the consequences of doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, I mean, and that does two things, right? It gives people some tangible examples, and it makes it less theoretical, right? Because you can kind of convey the same information through a slide deck or through sort of some kind of training, but it makes it so much more tangible and so much more personal to say, like, wow, this happened at our company, and this was something that really went wrong. To me, I mean, you know, I talk about this a lot, but we're all like wired for stories, right? We're all wired for storytelling. And when you hear a parable or you hear a rule, the parable always kind of resonates a little bit more. Why do you think, but I'll also say that this opacity or this lack of transparency from a corporate perspective is not uncommon. I mean, I hear about it all the time. I just think that like your case list or the closed cases or, you know, coming out of a DPA or whatever, there's so many great gems in there that you can leverage, just like you were able to do at Embraer. What do you think that, like, why doesn't everybody do that? To me, that seems such a great point of leverage to really kind of frame out the essence of the type of thing that we want to avoid and our commitment to sort of doing the right thing and sort of, you know, tearing back the curtain and showing people, you know, the sort of seedy underbelly of the company and where we made mistakes. There's a lot in that in terms of building an authentic culture. You know, everybody's talking about like a culture of integrity, but an authentic culture of integrity is really what we're going for. What prevents people from, you know, being willing to do it? Like, is it a fear thing? Is it, I mean, what is it, do you think?
I think people are wired to try not to be vulnerable. And I think the word is vulnerability, right? And this is connects not only to compliance, but to an HR culture. So at Embraer, we've been building with our CEO, we've been building, and our CEO and the VP of HR, building a culture where we say, we can be vulnerable and we can show vulnerability to each other. We as leaders also show our teams that we are vulnerable, that we are humans as everybody else. And I think when you show people what the company did wrong and you talk about these cases, you show vulnerability from a corporate standpoint. Like, the company is not immune to these things and the company did wrong. It has a touch of shame, right? It is shameful.
Sure.
To go to the public and say, we violated the FCPA in four different transactions. We paid a big price for it. We were on the news. It shows vulnerability, shows kind of shame. And I think that's why people in many instances are very afraid or very cautious when touching that. On the other hand, I think when you let people know what happened and you show, as you said, the underbelly, you show the vulnerability, I think you are more approachable. I think you connect more to people and you say, we're not immune to these things. We did the wrong thing. We learned from our experience. We are not heroes. But going forward, we are going to work together to make sure that it never happens again. And I think that vulnerability is what people in many corporations are afraid of.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's just so interesting because our job is really to influence human behavior. And authenticity is like the easiest lever to drive human behavior, or to let's just say to drive connection, right? Like you meet people at a networking event and they have that wall up and you can't make a connection with them. That's not like a like an actual relationship. But if you think about what your actual, you know, deep relationships you have with your family or your friends or your neighbors or whatever, there's a lot of authenticity there. And there's a lot more sort of like opportunity for influence when that sort of road or that, you know, yeah, let's call it a road of authenticity is kind of paved. And I think there's some weird disconnect that happens between companies and which are just human beings, right? Leaders, just human beings, and the human beings in the organization that they're trying to influence, where they think that that ingredient should not be in the dish. And it's like, no, you got to like double that ingredient in the dish. You know what I'm saying?
And one interesting thing, our DPA is public. If you go to the DOJ site, of course, you'll see it. There was one clause in there that said that we couldn't publicly, while the DPA was in effect, we couldn't publicly in any kind of interviews or media outlet of anything diminish what happened. We couldn't ever say, and this would be a violation of the DPA, say, yeah, we were in violation in four different transactions, but we didn't make much money about it. They were just isolated cases. We couldn't do that. And I think that's a very good indication of the fact that you should show vulnerability. In my trainings, I don't say, yeah, there were four transactions, but it wasn't the norm at the company, as you see in other companies or not. No, I give the right importance to the four transactions. I said there were four violations of the FCPA. Three of them involved briberies. One of them was books and records, but they were important violations, and we should pay attention to that, make sure that they don't happen again.
So let's zoom into this transition into Embraer. You joined at this pivotal moment. It was just kind of finalizing its DPA. What attracted you to that opportunity to leave DuPont, which was obviously a great company? You had a great career there. What attracted you to joining a company that was just sort of coming out of the DPA? And what was that like initial mindset you had coming into that situation?
Okay, so I think it was a conjunction of factors. I usually say that the stars aligned at that time. So DuPont had just announced that it was going through a transaction with Dow Chemical where they would join forces and then merge and then divide the company into three new companies. So I didn't know what the future would hold for me there. But of course, I was there for the long run. But it was a transitioning time for DuPont as well. And then for Embraer would be a totally different position for me, because at DuPont, I was the director of legal and compliance for Brazil and the Andean countries, which is Bolivia, Peru, Venezuela, Colombia. So it was like a scope that was big, but not as big as Embraer. Embraer, the title was VP of Legal and Compliance and Chief Compliance Officer and General Counsel. So it was global. So it would be the first time that there would be only the CEO above me, and I would be able to make all the decisions and to run a very big function and be at the very core of what was going on.
Wow.
Not only from a compliance perspective, from a legal perspective as well. So it was, of course, it was an upgrade from the position that I had. But always a headache from a position there, because I didn't have the level of responsibility and accountability that I had at Embraer, right? I always had a boss in legal and in compliance. And at the time I was doing also government affairs. So I had another function at DuPont, but I also had somebody to report to. And with Embraer, the buck stops here, right, with me.
So, that's kind of cool, right? Because you could kind of make it your own. You could put your own spin on it and make it, put your own English on the ball, as they say. Was it scary when you got the job, or were you just ready to roll your sleeves up and just, I mean, because it like Embraer is not a small company. It's a massive company. And you were kind of coming in at this really kind of, you know, again, this like pivotal time. Was there any feelings of anxiety that you're like, it's like the dog that finally catches the car, you know?
Again, showing the vulnerability, yes, a lot of anxiety. First thing, it was, so Embraer at the time, and it's still, I think it was around approximately 22,000 employees, was a big company.
Yeah.
And I was the only woman in the vice presidency. So we had a CEO, was a man. We had, I think at the time, 9 or 10 VPs. I was the only woman. We usually would make a joke because where we stayed there, where we sat in the corporate offices, there were 2 bathrooms, a men's and a women's bathroom. So I said that I had my private exclusive bathroom because I was the only woman to use it.
Yeah.
And I stayed like
the executive
that.
Bathroom. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my executive female. Like, so I stay like that. And I have to tell you, that was the first, I think, challenge that I had, be the only woman there. The second challenge, which was left me very anxious, was the whole investigation was dealt in a very confidential manner throughout the 6 years. There were leaks in the press, but internally, only those in the need-to-know basis knew about it, right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes, it was very
confidential. Was that by design? Was that like an Embraer decision, or was that like a function of the investigation itself?
I think it was a board decision at the time, but okay. And even our former chairman Ken Sakis, he says that in many interviews or panels that we participated together, that when it started, nobody in Brazil knew anything about FCPA. We were the first company to settle with the authorities in the US. Nobody knew what it was. And it started back in 2011, the investigation. So the board had this like knee-jerk reaction of everything's confidential. We don't know what this is. We don't know. And they took some time to longer than I think the U.S. authorities expected to take some decisions with regard to management, members of the management. And I think it was just dragging this way. So when we settled, I talked to the chairman to whom I reported from a compliance standpoint, I said, we have to open this up now. Everybody needs to know what happened. And back to our vulnerability thing. But at that time when I joined, it was very confidential. And none of my colleagues, the VPs, knew that I was joining the company. I was interviewed by the board only and the then CEO. But then 2 days before I started, the CEO changed. That CEO stepped down and a new one arrived.
Oh, wow.
Who was a VP. So he didn't even know that he was going to get a new direct report. First, my first day at Embraer, I was introduced to my new CEO. I said, hey.
And it was like his first
your
day
new
too.
VP of legal and compliance. Yes. He looked at me. And so that was the main challenge, I think, not only being the only woman, but nobody was expecting me there. And everybody was looking at me saying, what is she about? Why is she here?
Why does she get her own bathroom?
Yeah, or some of them thought that I had a mandate from the board to be like a police there.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, how did you navigate that? So they don't know you're coming. You have this sort of like, there's some kind of assumption, like you just said, presumably about like your role. You're the only woman. How do you navigate that? And how did you really kind of embed yourself in that leadership, you know, in that tier of leadership to like actually be effective?
So you have to start building trust. Nobody knows me. I don't know them. So you have to start building trust. So the first thing you have to build trust, and this was a lesson from DuPont, right? DuPont, the legal model in DuPont is that, the legal department model is that we are business partners. So we work with the businesses to make sure that we enable the businesses to grow. We are enablers and not Dr. Knows. Legal is not. And when I joined Embraer, legal was kind of a department of Dr. Knows. They would just say, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. It's very isolated from the businesses. And can imagine the VP seeing like a new general counsel starting there and chief compliance officer in the department.
Yeah.
So the first thing was that I did was a complete reorganization of the legal department. The compliance function was kind of starting, and we had a lot of room for improvement because we are still negotiating the DPA. But from the legal function that was all established, I did a lot of reorganization processes in there to make sure that I divided the sales to attend specific businesses. because they were divided in a corporate weird way. So I said, this team is going to work directly with commercial aviation. This team is going to support defense. This team is going to support executive aviation. And I start to build trust and say, hey, I'm not here to be the police. I'm not here to make it worse for you. I'm here to make it better for you. And I'm here to protect you. That's the thing that the compliance function needs to be viewed as a function that is here to help protect the company and protect the stakeholders and not to police any of them. Right. Yeah, and I think I was like slowly building trust in it.
Okay. So was it something that it was like, you know, you came in obviously with that mindset, you kind of had the chip stacked against you in some ways. Was it just kind of little by little and then all at once that trust was built? Or do you feel like there was a sort of a pivotal moment, like some kind of a tipping point where, you know, that trust was built? Do you understand what I'm asking? Like, or was it really this thing of like, you're just putting one foot in front of the other, and at some point you look back and you say, oh, wow, I've kind of built that trust. You know what I'm asking?
So it was both. In the beginning, what I did was I started to schedule lunch meetings with my colleagues individually and the CEO, just so they could get to know me. So like once a week, I would have lunch with each one of them. And I started to build those relationships with them. And we would all sit it was open office, but in a closed area just for the leadership, for the vice presidents and the CEO. So we would be together sitting side by side the whole day. So this is something that was naturally building. I had the lunches and I have meetings with them. But I think also because there was a time that I was negotiating. So I joined in June of 2016 and we settled in at the end of October of that year, 2016. So it was like 3-4 months that I was traveling a lot to DC to sit down with the DOJ. But I was also bringing back information to them, which they didn't have before.
Okay.
Right. So I think by just bringing information to them and letting them know that I was being totally transparent and I think totally transparent and protective of the company and of them. And I think I started to build that trust. So it was both. I was like pushing myself, but in their environment, but I was also, I think, trying to be as transparent as possible. So and some of them, it was very interesting because some of them would say to me during these lunches, wow, it's the first time that I'm hearing the whole story. It's the first time that somebody's really telling me what's going on.
Right. Well, yeah. And so you kind of really leveraged that kind of storm that the company was in to really build some trust a lot faster. You had information that they didn't know, and in probably conveying it, they could see how you were probably able to, like, you know, ostensibly demonstrate your drive to protect the organization and to protect them. That probably really kind of fast forwarded your trust building.
You know that saying, let's not waste a good crisis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's my favorite saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't waste a good crisis. But I think at the end, it was a very good learning experience for me as well, to learn that you can thrive even when you are anxious and getting an environment that is not really receptive. But at the end of the day, it all worked out.
So we're getting kind of to the end here, which is kind of regrettable because this should have been a double episode. I feel like I could talk to you for a whole nother hour.
I'm available.
I got a couple of more questions. So if you're talking to a compliance leader who's maybe never been through a DPA, but wants to prepare their company for that long-term resilience, because I think you did some really smart things coming out of that DPA to not let that be like a one-time event where the company sort of reverted back to some of those old things. What advice would you give them, or what tactics did you utilize to make this, you know, this crisis, as you said, the DPA, something that laid a foundation for a stronger culture of compliance many years after that was concluded?
Good question. So the first thing, as I said, never forget the past. And it's interesting because we are in 2025 now, and I was talking about 2017, 2018. Now I'm planning another round of trainings around the globe for the new people, because so many people joined the company and so many people left the company in this,
right,
all these years, that I think we are in deep need of a new training just so people know what went on, right? So the first thing that I said, never forget the past. And even for compliance officers who are not undergoing an investigation through a DPA, use other companies' examples. And as I said, it's like use other companies' stories to let them know that if you think compliance is expensive, try non-compliance. It's so much more expensive and so much more draining on the company's morale and culture. Right? That's the first thing. Second thing, I think, to make sure that you have the right controls in place, you need the tone at the top. You need to make sure that your colleagues and that your leadership is on board with that. So I usually say that my CEO is my main advertising guy for compliance, and he is, and the other VPs as well, especially the VPs of the businesses or functions that are more vulnerable, like our defense business, for example. They work only with governments. It's where we are most vulnerable, right? Or where we sell to the Brazilian government. We sell a lot to the Brazilian Air Force. So the defense business is very vulnerable. And I have to make sure that the VP in charge of the defense business, the defense business CEO, is my advertising guy for compliance. There's no way to build culture. There's no way to build a strong compliance program without the tone at the top and without your leadership being the ones to cascade this into their organizations. They have to be the first ones to do the right thing.
So how do you actually get them to be that advertisement? Are you giving them, are you recording them on videos? Are you giving them talking points to try to integrate into things? Like, because it's such a, I mean, they're a very loud instrument, right? The, whatever they say, you know, a whisper from the top can feel like a yell down below. I find a lot of compliance folks don't really leverage those assets to the extent that they can to drive the influence and drive and influence the behaviors where those sort of risk owners are or where those points of risk are. So like, what tactics have you employed to really, you know, get them singing from your song sheet in a more consistent way?
There are tactics that you can see, the ones that where teams cannot see, right? The ones you can see, and you're right, I have them record videos, I have them provide training. I invite them. I have, for example, once a year, I have the annual meeting of the, our compliance agents. We have compliance agents. We have, I think, almost 200 compliance agents spread throughout Embraer. They are in the businesses and functions, and they are our eyes and ears. They give capillarity to our program within their respective organizations. And I have the sponsorship of the VPs for that. So these are the what you can see. You can see the compliance agents providing training. You can see the VPs doing videos. You can see we have in all like once a month we show all the VPs in the management meetings. We show the KPIs of compliance and where we are on everything and deliveries. What you cannot see is when I need the VP to understand the risks of his or her business or function. Mm-hmm. If a leader is not aware of the risks that they are exposed, there's no way they can cascade compliance. Good and point. How we do that? Yes, the first thing, we every 2 years, we have a risk assessment conducted by an outside consultant. And the risk assessment also entails, like, I think, the interviews of 60 to 80 different leaders in the company. And when we interview, we have a thermometer to see if they are aware of the businesses they are exposed to. Smart. And if they're not, I train them. That. So I get one of like the VPs, I talked about defense. Let's go back to defense businesses again. And I said, do you know what your risks are? Do you know when you go to a country, I say in Asia or Africa to sell, do you know what you have to do if somebody asks for something that we are not able to give because it's illegal? And at the end of the day, once they see the risks that they are exposed to and they are aware, they are the first ones to say no when no needs to be said.
Yeah, so I guess you're right. You have to drive that awareness. And once that awareness is in place, then they're naturally going to try to put that little fire out or make sure that, you know, that wheel doesn't fall off the car or whatever. or the wing doesn't fall off the plane. Okay, I'll bring it home for you. So my last question is for you. If you could go back in time and find a young Fabiana and give her a piece of advice you wish you had earlier, what would that be?
Let me think. Piece of advice. That's a very good thing. I don't deal with regrets. So I think everything I did, even the wrong things I did, even the wrong things I did were for a purpose because they helped me learn. I think if I could give an advice was in some instances where I was very close to burnout or burned out because of work, just to sit down, like smell the roses, you know, like reassess it and pay a little more attention to aspects other than just a professional, you know. Sometimes I think in my past I let the ball drop, personally speaking, because I was working like crazy times and overnight and traveling a lot, especially I think 2018 was my worst year because we were at the same time with the monitorship on one hand and on the other side negotiating with Boeing the deal that we were going to sell commercial aviation to them, and it was terminated in 2020. But I think it was my worst, for you to have an idea, in 2018 I had I think 16 stamps in my passport from February to November.
Wow.
Going to the US, yes, like twice a month. And I think I would go back and say, don't do that. There are other ways. Now, after COVID, that you see that you can do a lot of things virtually, like we're doing now, I would say, try to find different ways of doing things to be more present at home. And I think, but I learned from that experience. Again, no regrets, because that made me learn to align my priorities.
Yeah, that's good advice. I mean, it's so hard though, when you're in the thick of it all, to know like what matters and what doesn't matter, because it feels like everything matters and you have to do it all. And you know, you're carrying that weight of the world on your shoulders.
Exactly.
Man, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us on the Ethics Experts. We got to do something again soon.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll do. I'm totally available.
Awesome.
Thank you, Nick.